from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to Washington Watch. Yes, it's me, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins today on this Wednesday edition and for the remainder of your week. We've got some very big stories and some big guests today, and I'm excited to get started. Earlier this morning, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights announced it had issued a notice of violation letter indicating that the University of Vermont Medical Center broke the law by forcing a nurse to assist in an elective abortion procedure over her objections. In just a minute, I'll talk with Roger Severino, Director of the Office of Civil Rights for Health and Human Services. In my second segment, a group of concerned Christians and former homosexuals held a press conference yesterday outside the California Capitol. They explained why they oppose a California Assembly Concurrent Resolution 99, which silences the voice of pastoral counselors and stigmatizes Christian or secular counselors for reaching out to and providing services to those who struggle with unwanted same-sex attraction. Elizabeth Woning, co-founder of the Changed Movement, will join me. At the bottom of the hour, Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke told a voter to his face on Monday that he would be okay with his mother aborting him the day before his birth. I've got the audio, and we'll talk with Dr. Michael New, an associate scholar with the Charlotte Lozier Institute. And in my last segment at 42 past the hour, higher education, as we all know, is dominated by the left, and even religious institutions of higher learning seem to be unmoored and growing lefter by the day. So where should conservative students turn for help? We will answer that pressing question with Charlie Copeland, president of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. As a reminder, go to TonyPerkins.com, the podcast website for today, where we have, among other things, a blog post relative to our first segment on today's Washington Watch. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me at Sarah P. Perry. Well, going to our first story of the day, earlier this morning, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office for Civil Rights announced that it has issued a notice of violation letter finding that the University of Vermont Medical Center broke the law by forcing a nurse to assist in an elective abortion procedure over her religious objections. Joining me now is Roger Severino, Director of the Office of Civil Rights for Health and Human Services. Roger, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
So on May 9th of last year, a nurse at the University of Vermont Medical Center filed a conscience and religious discrimination complaint with the Office of Civil Rights and claimed, in short, that the University of Vermont Medical Center had tricked her into showing up for an abortion procedure. Can you tell us a little bit about the backstory here?
Yeah, that's right. This is a tragic case. That never should have happened in this day and age in America. This was a nurse who was dedicated to help saving lives, who was in fact coerced into participating in the taking of life through an abortion. She had registered her objections to participating in abortions, yet the University of Vermont Medical Center decided in 2017 to start doing elective abortions without informing staff. And this nurse was actually scheduled for a procedure that she thought was related to a miscarriage, but was in fact told when she arrived, please don't hate me by the doctor, because the doctor knew that this was going to be an abortion and that this nurse was going to be put in a horrendous position where she would face a crisis of conscience. In that very moment, she tried to raise her objection again to see if she could be replaced, and she could have actually been replaced even at that late hour with somebody else who would have been willing to do it, yet the hospital refused. And this is on pain of potentially losing her job or being reported to licensing bodies, which would threaten her ability to practice medicine at all. And put in that horrendous situation, she gave in, and it has traumatized her. This is a real moral injury that, regardless of what you think about Roe v. Wade or the legality of abortion, the American people have spoken in a unified voice that we cannot coerce people to participate in abortions, to pay for abortions, to refer for abortions, to cover abortions against their will. And that is precisely what happened here. And that is a quintessential violation, not only of common justice, but of federal law that my office, the Office for Civil Rights, is charged with enforcing.
And what an untenable position in which to find yourself, knowing in your heart of hearts that this is something you are absolutely opposed to because your religious conscience dictates it, and then fearing that you have one of two options, assist with the procedure or lose your job, which isn't a choice that anyone has to make. So you also found that the University of Vermont Medical Center had actually implemented discriminatory policies of assigning or requiring employees to assist abortions even after those employees had recorded their religious or moral objections. So they actually maintained a list of those individuals who had a conscience objection and yet flagrantly disregarded the list.
Yes, in the particular nurse's instance, it was absolutely clear what happened. However, they still had a policy in place, even after this incident, that specifically contemplated a situation where under UVMMC, the hospital's own discretion, they could decide what their staffing needs would be in any particular moment and could require anybody, regardless of whether or not they put in a objection, whether they put it in writing, whatever, they could still require them to undergo participate in the procedure despite their objections. The burden that is put on the hospital by the law to accommodate all medical staff on this issue. The church amendments were passed right after Roe v. Wade to make clear that medical professionals should never be put in that position. If there's a staffing concern, the duty is on the hospital to create the proper staff rotation to do whatever services they want to provide. And by the way, the hospital had not been providing elective abortion services until 2017. So one option for every hospital is to not provide abortion services. They're not required. Another option is to create proper staffing protocols to make sure that this never happens and nobody's put in this position if they have an objection. And the third option is to not receive federal funds. If you don't want the strings that are attached that go with our laws designed to protect conscience, you also have that option. Here, the University Medical Center did the wrong thing and did the coercion and did not change their policy to come into compliance. And our main purpose is to get compliance with the law. That is really what we're seeking here. And with our notice of violation, we've put the University of Vermont Medical Center on notice as to the violations, as to the ongoing nature of their policies being in violation of the law. And we're giving another opportunity to come into compliance, or else they will be referred to the funding components, which they received $1.6 million over the last 3 years from the Health Resources Services Administration at HHS. We always seek voluntary compliance before we escalate to a procedure that could eventually lead to revocation of federal funds. But in any event, the law has to be complied with, and we're hoping that with this notice, they will finally come into compliance.
Have the administrative officials here at University of Vermont Medical Center, have they answered in any way? Have they offered any defense to the claim that there was an abuse, a violation of these church amendments in the United States Code? Any response at all?
They have not taken appropriate responsibility for their actions. They need to acknowledge the violation by changing their policies. What we're looking for is compliance, and we're giving them every chance to respond to our document requests, but they have been incomplete. They have not been fully cooperative. We offered to interview their staff and went out there, made ourselves available. They declined our offer for us to interview their staff. So we proceeded with our investigation as we are required to do. The laws have meaning only if they are enforced. So we proceeded with our investigation, interviewed several folks that were intimately familiar with what happened, complainants, et cetera, and got the necessary information to substantiate this finding of violation. It's pretty black and white under the law. The law says if you receive federal funds, you cannot force doctors or nurses to perform abortions, period. And this is an outrageous violation of that fundamental right. And it's really a matter of common decency. You don't put people in that position when they have informed you that it goes so deeply against their religious beliefs and moral convictions, especially when we're talking about doctors and nurses that really just want to heal people and help people.
Well, and to indicate that this doctor actually turned to the nurse and said, "Don't hate me," indicating automatically This was a position of full cognition. This individual knew exactly what he was requesting of this nurse. Absolutely boggles the mind. So your office in this press release has determined that there is an element of moral injury here. There is a crisis of conscience and emotional distress. It's not just the violation of the conscience protections and of one's own religious convictions, but it is also all of the attendant emotional injury that comes along with it. Now, in your discussions, in your investigation with this nurse, has she given you any indication as to what her particular emotional fallouts have been on this?
This is a sad, tragic story. And this is a universal problem when a person is faced with this crisis of conscience. We do not require, for example, doctors to assist in executions, and pharmacists aren't required to put the lethal cocktail together. Doctors are not required to perform assisted suicides. We should also have that same respect and solicitude when it comes to the taking of life and abortion. And that is actually the state of the law. And I'm glad that I'm privileged to be the leader of a Office for Civil Rights that now has a Conscience and Religious Freedom Division dedicated specifically to enforcing our conscience and religious freedom laws, just like every other civil right. This has been missing for far too long, where we now have a culture where doctors, nurses, and hospital administrators think that somehow this is okay, or think that somehow this does not violate federal law when it does. And we're doing a lot to raise the profile of these issues to make sure that, no, this is actually against the law and that we are here to enforce the law. And we welcome people to submit complaints to us, hhs.gov/OCR. That's for Office for Civil Rights. If you feel that your conscience and religious freedom rights have been violated, health information privacy rights have been violated, or your civil rights generally have been violated, we welcome everybody to submit their complaints. That's the only way we're going to be able to address these issues and to start changing the underlying culture that led to such a tragic situation as was present in this case.
So we've got about a minute left, but give our listeners a sense of what happens next in this process.
Well, the ball is really in the University of Vermont Medical Center's court. We have been as accommodating as we could be. We've given them another 30 days to come forward and say they're willing to work with us, and coming into compliance with the law. I mean, I even had a conversation with the governor of the state, the governor's office of the state of Vermont today, and I made the same offer. If there's any instance where you think there's a question, come to us. We're here to help you be in compliance with federal law. And that offer still stands. However, that offer does have an expiration date. At some point, the compliance has to actually come into effect. People who receive federal funds must comply with federal law. And if they don't want to voluntarily resolve this matter with us, then there will be further appropriate action.
Roger Severino, we appreciate so much the excellent work that you do at the Office of Civil Rights there at HHS. He has been my guest today, the executive director there of OCR, the Department of the Health and Human Services Agency. Again, hhs.org/OCR. If you want to file a complaint yourself, you are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships. Coming up next, a group of concerned Christians and former homosexuals held a press conference yesterday explaining why they oppose California Assembly Resolution 99, which silences the voice of the church and counselors helping those with unwanted attractions. Elizabeth Woning, co-founder of the Changed Movement, joins me next on Washington Watch.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting here for Tony Perkins on this Wednesday afternoon. And yesterday in Sacramento, California, a group of concerned Christians and former homosexuals held a press conference outside the California Capitol in opposition to California Assembly Resolution 99. It silences the voice of church and stigmatizes counseling for people who struggle with unwanted same-sex desires. After the press conference, a number of the group spoke in front of the California Senate Judiciary Committee to offer their testimonies. But one of the people who spoke at the press conference beforehand was Dean Broyles, the director of the Center for Law and Public Policy. Let's listen to what he said.
The government has no jurisdiction to dictate to the church what it should believe, do, say, or how it should counsel citizens. Why? Because the First Amendment, embedded in the Constitution's Bill of Rights, guarantees our unalienable rights and fundamental civil rights, including the free exercise of religion and the freedom of speech. ACR 99 is an attempt to control the beliefs, words, and practices of citizens regarding the controversial and sensitive topic of human sexuality. It targets, chills, and suppresses free speech and religious free exercise. Furthermore, it unfairly disparages religious groups and people, blaming them for mental health problems and high suicide rates in the LGBT community. The right to dissent is a fundamental American right, robustly protected by the First Amendment. The state of California does not have the authority to define a one-size-fits-all sexual ideology or to enforce its sexual orthodoxy on people of faith. Sexual orientation and gender identity are not fixed. They're fluid. People can change. People do change. Our citizens, especially those who have faith, should remain free to have the choice to seek out change-allowing therapy without the state trying to destroy that choice through Orwellian legislation like ACR 99.
So joining me now to discuss this is Elizabeth Woning, who was there yesterday, co-founder of the Changed Movement. You can learn more at the website changedmovement.com. She once lived a life identifying as a lesbian before God transformed her heart and no longer identifies as such. Elizabeth, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hello, Sarah.
So I have a great question to kick this off because there's a bit of an interesting backstory here. Democratic State Assemblyman Evan Lowe, who is a homosexual, tried to get a bill passed last year that outlawed what a lot of people colloquially refer to as conversion therapy, okay, addressing this type of voluntary therapeutic counseling service. This is where counselors and pastors help people who are struggling with unwanted same-sex attraction. And I say this specifically because we are not talking coerced. This is voluntary counseling. So why did he pull that bill from consideration last year, and why now a non-binding resolution?
Well, none of us know specifically why he pulled the bill. I think there's conjecture that he recognized, or the LGBT caucus recognized, that it was unconstitutional. There was a Supreme Court case, the NIFLA Becerra Supreme Court case last year, that spoke directly to the issue. But then Evan Lowe took a very unusual approach, and he responded to many of us Christians by traveling the state and talking to Christian leaders about the impact of this bill. And within that, there were conversations that led him to believe that a resolution could equally kind of do the work that he wanted to do. So, I mean, he gathered a group of pastors and a group of LGBT activists to work together to create this resolution.
Why do you, and why does your organization oppose this California resolution?
Well, because it says specifically, or it wants to tell California that if you experience same-sex attraction, there is only one option. And if you choose any other option in addressing your sexuality, that is personally harmful. So, you know, there are two really bad problems with ACR 99. One is conversion therapy is never clearly defined. So for us in any church, any person, any Christian or non-Christian seeking the Lord for the truth of their sexuality in prayer, even, that could be considered conversion therapy because it is a sexual change orientation or sexual orientation change approach. And so there's never any definition of conversion therapy. But then also, and this is the part that particularly bothers me, is that it connects faith-based approaches to sexuality with higher incidence of suicide among teens.
Mm. Which is a rather dangerous connection to make as far as people of faith are concerned. And you wrote an excellent piece, I have to quote it, The Not-So-Subtle Discrimination of ACR 99. ACR 99 is a perfect example of the resolution celebrating and highlighting California's LGBT people, but it also suggests there's only one right way to honor and protect them. And you go on to mention the fact that this is really a form of religious discrimination because it has connected the faith element as part of the ACR, hasn't it?
That's right, yeah. And really, that's what Dean Broyles was getting at. This really erodes our self-expression and our ability to really control or have independent thought. It really impacts how a person shapes his own or her own sexuality.
And that's in terms of what I have heard from other pundits, other individuals who are either practitioners of this type of counseling or therapy, or they have benefited from it. Really, at bottom, it comes down to a free speech right, doesn't it? Because what we're attempting to do is muzzle individuals who provide these voluntary services and then saying you are discriminatory if you provide them, which ironically, Elizabeth, you have gone from one segment of the population who what I've identified as such to be in a discriminated against category to now, as a Christian, someone who deals with a different type of discrimination, a brave woman, Elizabeth Wonin.
That is the great irony. Thank you so much, Sarah.
It is. So glad that you could join us today. This is Washington Watch. I've got Dr. Michael New, a scholar with Charlotte Lozier Institute, to talk about Beto O'Rourke and some comments on abortion that you won't quite believe. Coming up next.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Wednesday edition. Well, Beto O'Rourke on Monday used a campaign stop at the College of Charleston to reestablish his extreme pro-abortion platform. And we have some audio of an exchange between he and an audience goer. Let's listen.
Someone asked you specifically about third trimester abortions, and you said that it's a decision left up to the mother. So my question is this. I was born September 8, 1989, and I want to know if you think on September 7th my life had no value.
Of course I don't think that. Of course I'm glad that you're here. But you referenced my answer in Ohio, and it remains the same. This is a decision that neither you nor I nor the United States government should be making. That's a decision for the woman to make. We want her to have the best possible access to care and to a medical provider. I don't question the decisions that a woman makes. I mean, only she knows what she knows, and I want to trust her with that.
Well, I'm going to cut right to the chase with my next guest, the excellent Dr. Michael New, who is an associate scholar at the Charlotte Lozier Institute. Welcome to Washington Watch, Dr. New.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's get right to it. What was your reaction to Beto O'Rourke's comments? And kudos to that young man for asking a tough question. What did you think?
Yeah, that was tough, being on a college campus where there's lots of people who support legal abortion.
Yes.
That was not easy, so I give that individual a lot of credit. His answer was obviously contradictory. I mean, he says he's glad the guy is here. He says his life has value, but he doubles down on his support for late-term abortion. In fact, he doubles down on support for abortion one day before the mother's due. And I just think that really shows how out of step and radical that Beto O'Rourke and other Democrats are with public opinion. Poll after poll after poll shows that a vast majority of Americans oppose these late-term abortions. And the fact you've been to O'Rourke doubling down on this Republican campaign event, again, really shows how out of step he is with the American public.
It's very easy to believe that the crowd who is cheering something like the mother knows what the mother knows is not recognizing the fact that only 6% approve of abortion up until the day before birth, and only 8% of Americans approve it within the third trimester. So he's really sort of trying to have it both ways. He's ignoring the data, he's pandering to the crowd, and he's also telling this young man that his life has value, which is very frustrating to me going into this election season.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a very broad body of public opinion data showing that most Americans are not comfortable with abortion on demand. They want some limits, support for third trimester abortions, limits on second trimester abortions, other criminal pro-life laws like waiting periods, parental involvement laws, limits on taxpayer funding for elective abortions. These all pull well. But interestingly, no Democrat, not Beto O'Rourke, not anybody running for president on the Democratic side is supporting even incremental limits. And again, I just really think that shows how out of step, out of touch they are with the American public.
They've gotten so extreme. Well, he went on to discuss the fact that because of what are known as trap laws, these are targeted regulations of abortion providers. And these are common sense medical health and safety laws. They are licensing regulations that it is now impossible for women to get access to cervical cancer screening or a family planning provider. And he said that maternal mortality rates are up in the state of Texas. Women are dying because of the regulations. Is that true?
No, it's not. And it's very frustrating because Beto O'Rourke keeps saying this. He made similar comments in Nevada back in April, and he made similar comments at the College of Charleston this week. And it's simply not true. There was a study that came out in 2016 by the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and they did find an increase in maternal mortality in Texas. But there were coding errors with the data set they used. Yes. Another team of scholars looked at this data, reviewed it, and they published their findings in the same journal in 2018 and found that, no, there was no spike in maternal mortality in Texas. The problem was the early study got a lot of attention. People wanted to use that study to claim that funding cuts to Planned Parenthood hurt maternal mortality in Texas. But the revised study, which showed that there was no increase in the maternal mortality rate, got some attention, but not as much. And this misinformation is being circulated. And again, it's frustrating. Some people, when they made a mistake, have been honest and forthright about it. Congressman Don Beyer at a Ways and Means Committee hearing made a similar mistake. But unlike Beto O'Rourke, he admitted he was wrong and called it an honest error. Beto O'Rourke keeps spreading this misinformation. And it's just very troubling that you have someone running for president who just doesn't have the basic facts down.
And it indicates yet again that we are seeing left-wing candidates, particularly Democratic presidential candidates, because now we have them on record with a number of different debates and campaign stops this early in the trail. They are ultimately trying to outleft each other. These are not common sense restrictions on abortions. They are zero restrictions at all. If you and I were sitting here 8 years ago, never in a million years would I think we would be talking about abortion a day before birth. Are you as shocked as I am by this?
I am, and also I'm not. Unfortunately, there's been some kind of demographic shifts within the Democratic Party. And for a long time, part of the Democratic Party's coalition was kind of older Democrats who came of age during either the Great Depression or World War II. And they tend to be a lot more conservative on these social issues. That generation's passed away. Someone who was 10 when the Great Depression happened is probably 99 now, if they're still alive. So, again, there's the base of the Democratic Party is a lot more liberal, a lot more aggressive. And sadly, Beto O'Rourke is pandering to this, you know, very liberal crowd.
Dr. Michael New, scholar with the Charlotte Lozier Institute, has been my excellent guest today. You are listening to Washington Watch. Coming up next, something we've talked about but needs repeating, is there left-wing bias in higher education? And what's a conservative student to do? I'll be joined next by president of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, Charlie Copeland, about where conservative students can turn. Coming up next on Washington Watch.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony Perkins. As a reminder, go to TonyPerkins.com, our website for today's podcast. Resources, action steps, information on our guests, things you'll want to know. Well, this is a subject I love to talk about. I truly do not grow tired of it, and it is most apropos at this time of the year when individuals are getting ready to go back to college, parents are packing kids off for college, or they have already started their classes. But we do know for a fact that higher education is dominated by the left. So where do our conservative students turn for help, and is college still worth it? Charlie Copeland is president of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. He holds a BS and an MBA from Duke University, worked with the DuPont Company, and spent more than two decades as president of Associates International, growing the company from a nine-person operation into an internationally recognized firm. From 2002 to 2008, he served as a Delaware state senator, rising through to the position of Senate Minority Leader. Charlie, welcome to Washington Watch.
Sarah, thank you so much for having it. It's such a joy for me.
Well, let's talk about this. The fact that most Ivy League schools, Yale, Harvard, Duke, were founded to train Christian ministers and actually to advance the gospel of Jesus. Knowing this, how did we stray so far afield? And why is it today that we find so much of higher education dominated by left-wing ideologies?
Yeah, that is a central question. Duke was founded as a Methodist school, and actually the West Campus, which was built by the Duke family, is laid out in the shape of a cross with the Duke Chapel at the head of the cross.
Wow.
And yet you would be you would not know that today because it, other than being a beautiful architectural monument, it's not central at all to what happens on campus. And as a matter of fact, about 5 years ago, there was a movement by a Muslim student association to be able to issue the Friday call to prayer from the Duke Chapel. And it was initially given the okay. And so many alumni rose up and said, you can't do that. That it was then rescinded, but it's been a long trail that has taken us away from those central Christian ideals that these universities were founded on and by. And you know, since World War II, I mean, you know, the first president of ISI, a seat that I have today, was held by William F. Buckley Jr., Bill mm-hmm. Buckley, and it was after he'd written God and Man at Yale in 1951. And he was our first president in 1953. So we've been around a long time, but we've watched this get increasingly worse and increasingly worse as every generation of new faculty and administrator at these schools. And it's not just the Ivy Leagues anymore. It's almost every school has become a member of the secular left wing, full of just this nihilistic tendency that just really does beat down on the souls and spirit of college campus.
Well, and what we know is that post election, post 2016, we heard so much of the discussion about the voters that elected, for example, Republican President Donald Trump were from what individuals sneeringly referred to as flyover country, right? So those areas in the middle of the country that are populated by predominantly conservative thinkers, more Republican voters, whereas the East and West Coasts, those known as conservative elite bastions, who have a tendency to be located toward the most prestigious schools in the country. These are the ones who are promulgating left-wing ideas in the university and producing students inclined toward left-wing ideals who, because of their education, are in higher income brackets and then electing the next generation of left-wing politicians. So it's a bit of a self-perpetuating cycle. And as I have said to some colleagues here, really, the college and university is the crux of where these ideas are tested and tried, either true or false, because we have them only for a little while. We have these kids until they are 18, and then if God tarries, they are off to college, as they will be in my house. We have told them that is cost of entry. But beyond that, you have to think, okay, they are subject to the heavy-duty influence of their professors, their faculty, their administrators. So let's talk about your institute for a minute. Give me a little bit about the structure of ISI and how it actually works to assist conservative students and produce free thinkers.
Absolutely. So we have a network of faculty on campuses across the country that numbers around 3,000. And that total mm-hmm. faculty count is on about 37% of all campuses across the country. So it is likely that many of your listeners' children or grandchildren or nieces and nephews are going to a college where we have a faculty associate, somebody who engages with us. We have content, we have curriculum ideas, we have student programming, and we work with these faculty members to identify students, to build those bring those students into our programming. ISI sort of functions as a para-university, para meaning next to. And so we provide what most of the colleges and universities today do not provide, and that is an education in those foundational principles. And we do that through our faculty network of associates. We do that through the curriculum and content that we've built since 1953, decades of material. We do that by having a staff that visits campuses and builds societies. We have student societies on over 100 campuses today. We have conservative student journals, newspapers, investigative newspapers on 57 campuses today. And when you add that all up, we're on about 40% of America's college campuses. But so that's how we do it. It's legwork. It's identifying students. It's having these faculty out there that identify a student in a class, or that student has identified to the faculty member and says, hey, I'm interested in the idea. There are conservative professors. It's only about 10% at the most, and in some cases much less than that, but they are out there. And in addition to that, there actually are, again, it's a small percent, a number of liberal faculty who believe in the free exchange of ideas and will also often have be able to direct students to them. They're going to be getting a liberal faculty member, but one that's not going to just force dogma on the student and allow the student to actually exercise their free speech, free thought, learn critical thinking skills. So one I would recommend is any student or son or daughter, granddaughter, grandson, go to join.isi.org, join.isi.org, and put in your name and email address and other stuff there, and we will get you an intellectual starter kit, which will include Russell Kirk's book about the American founding and the American principles. And then we'll also get a weekly email of content, conservative content from thinkers that go all the way back to our Judeo-Christian founding, as well as Greece and Rome through the Renaissance and the Enlightenment to today. And it's, you know, and we can dial you into our network and start getting you to societies, debates, lectures, other content. And it is possible, but if you're a conservative, you have to work for it. If you just want to be a liberal, they'll all give it to you. And by the way, you will get it.
So much easier. It's so much easier to just lap it all up, isn't it? Talking points and nothing more. So here's an interesting question. I don't know if you've ever been asked this before. Do you believe that conservatives are smarter than liberals? I'm really holding your feet to the fire in this one.
Yeah, you know, that's a fascinating question. And I think that conservatives understand that we are fallen creatures and that we are not perfectible, that we are all in the gutter, just some of us are looking at the stars, and we want to do better by our fellow man. And the way to do that is to recognize where we are in the hierarchy of things, that there is a higher power, and that our individual responsibilities and individual rights and individual dignity comes from that. It doesn't come from, you know, what subgroup of intersectionality I belong to. And I think there's a fundamental difference in that piece of it, where I do think that many on the left think that, well, you know, if we just build the machine right, it will all, you know, will all be perfect. And that's just factually not true. So why they choose to continually ignore that, you know, in the humanities departments across the country, 18% of humanities professors, 18%, almost one in five, are self-identified Marxists.
Oh, now, wow.
This is a political philosophy that has never been successfully implemented. It's 0-for-40. And yet, only 5% are self-identified conservatives. And the rest of them are just liberal. So we're outnumbered in the humanities, 1-19, and almost four times as many faculty are Marxists, self-identified Marxists. So you could get back to your question, are conservatives smarter? It would seem to me that if I believed in a philosophy that had never been successfully implemented and had failed and killed tens of millions of humans in the last 100 years, that I would open my eyes and say, you know what? The facts don't support my beliefs. I have to change my beliefs. And the fact that they do not do that is indicative of some sort of closed-mindedness.
I love what you said about some of us are in the gutter, but we're looking up at the stars. That is beautiful. I will use it, but I will be sure to attribute it to you, Charlie. Now, I have to say I'm fascinated by the fact that you do have self-identifying liberals among some of the faculty advisors that you have, but those who are intellectually honest, right? So we see so much of the progressive left repeating these convenient talking points, unresearched, but they are highly palatable. It makes for a great Twitter war and for the repetition of these notes when one wants to dominate by using a tactic like Bulverism and eliminating any characteristic research behind something. But here's what I want to know. I want to know about some of your illustrious alumni, because the list of those who have participated in ISI is really impressive.
It absolutely is. And the central thing that we do is we try to identify deep-thinking, intellectually curious conservatives on campus. And these are young people that are going to be leaders when they graduate. They might be leaders in their local community. They might be leaders in their state. And in many cases, they're leaders in our country. And we want to make sure that they understand those foundational principles of what makes a society free and prosperous, so free markets, individual liberty, freedom of religion, limited government, all these kinds of things that we know work. And so once we identify them and we educate them, they indeed go on to be the leader that we expected them to be. So, for instance, both Sam Alito and Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court were both in ISI programming when they were in college. And the Neil Gorsuch in particular, but several others have been promulgated or pushed forward by the Federalist Society, which is a society that works with lawyers. And the Federalist Society was started by three ISI alumni. So they're sort of a derivative of us, but that's the kind of people that come through our programming. Larry Arne, who's the president of Hillsdale College, who's on my board, was an ISI Weaver Fellow. And Ed Fulner, who started the Heritage Foundation and many other things, is also on my board and was an ISI Weaver Fellow. And I could go on. There's just a lot of great people. Secretary John Layman, the Navy Secretary under Ronald Reagan. Ken Cribb, who used to be our president, was Ronald Reagan's domestic policy advisor. Dick Allen, who was Reagan's first national security advisor. These are just alumni. And today we've got folks that are in the Trump administration that I believe in the next 4, 5, 10 years you will see again and again and again, because they're going to help lead our country and keep us safe and secure in an increasingly dangerous world. And so that's what we do, is we educate those young people. And for all those that I've mentioned, there are hundreds that are at the state level, in business, in nonprofits, in the academy. We have 600 of our graduate fellows. So we provide fellowships to folks getting their PhDs in history or economics that want to go into faculty. 600 of them are teaching on college campus today.
Oh, wow.
And every year they have classes of dozens of students that have a true professor who wants them to develop critical thinking skills and knowledge in their subject area. And so that's a long, long tail that we have as an impact on keeping America safe and free and open for all of us to practice our faith.
Okay, I'm going to give you one last question, but it's a hard one, and you only have a minute to answer it. So we've got some guidelines here. Do you think the cost of college and college itself is still worth it for the rising conservative student?
I think that has to be made as an individual decision. I think the broad answer is perhaps not. You have to be very, very careful in what you do and where you spend your money. I would not recommend putting on $25,000 to $50,000 in debt to get a degree in early Mayan studies. I think that you want a degree that teaches you critical thinking skills, and you want to take that from faculty who want to promote your ability to think critically. And so I think you need to be very, very questionable about where you go and what classes you take. It's your money. You want to spend it wisely.
Oh, Charlie, I wish we had more time. This has been a fascinating interview and so compelling about where we ought to spend our time, our efforts, and our intellectual minds, our curiousness, our ability to have a discussion with individuals who will help grow our minds and not stunt them. Charlie Copeland of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. This has been Washington Watch. Thanks for being with us today. TonyPerkins.com is the podcast website, and we'll be together tomorrow on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.